We're here to make a dent in the universe, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out all the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Brumner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them. Hello and welcome to my podcast. And we have a property veteran with us today, and that's Andrew Weir. Now, Andrew gained his industry-wide reputation as a professional in the property sector with over 30 years' experience during a period of unprecedented growth and change within the prime central London real estate market. Now, he was involved from the early stages of setting up Foxtons to managing its growth and creating one of the best-known brands in the industry, taking it from private ownership to private equity and initial public offering. And he held the position of managing director from 2014, subsequently becoming the chief sales officer at Foxtons. More recently, however, he was appointed the CEO of one of the capital's premier dedicated buying agencies, London Central Portfolio, in March 2020. Now, I think that what's very interesting around Andrew's career is his in-depth knowledge of this property market, especially the prime London property market. And that's something that we're going to talk to him a lot about today. Thank you very much to Andrew for joining us. Andrew, thank you and welcome today. And let's dive straight in with property prices. Now, I got this completely wrong, I have to admit. House prices are up 10% year on year on a number of different indices. What actually has fueled this, in your opinion?
I don't think anyone really called that one, did they? But then nobody called the pandemic. So I think the whole thing's taken all of us by surprise. So I think it's important to understand when you read the headlines about double-digit growth in house prices over the last 12 months or so, it's really important to understand that that is not remotely uniform. That's very much the regions beyond London. So it's not a London phenomenon at all. London historically usually leads the way, and it usually sees much quicker growth and much sharper, more aggressive price growth than the rest of the UK. And during the last 12 months since the pandemic kicked in, we've seen a flip, a reversal of that, where people have been moving out of London, and the London property has really fueled the ability to grow prices in the regions beyond the UK. And I think it's sort of well known where those places are. They're sort of remoter locations with the people with the benefit of being able to work remotely have sought to sort of take advantage of, really. So I think that in essence is what sort of fueled it, combined with the stamp duty holiday, which really encouraged a lot of people and added to the volume of activity. But I also think it's a bit of pent-up demand. I think we've had, three lockdowns? And I think during those periods, even when technically the estate agency market was allowed to operate, there were significant groups of people who didn't want their house on the market. They perceived it as a bad time to sell. They didn't want people wandering around their house. A lot of them had children at home doing homeschooling. So we've had these sort of off periods when very little was going on. And then as the lid was lifted and people were allowed to operate more easily, we've had these sort of spikes of activity. So who knows how long that will last. I suspect personally that it will sort of balance off a little bit over the next 12 months. I don't think you'll see a drop as such, but I think you'll see a sort of a cooling and a moderation and a sort of more of a normalization of things in terms of what's going on beyond London. Then in terms of what's happened in London, obviously it's a very different story. Prime central London, which is the area I've sort of spent most of my time working in over the years, it's always been the case, but it became much more the case, far more exaggerated from 2008 onwards, from the credit crunch onwards, we had this huge influx of overseas buyers, a different sort of buyer to the one that we had pre-financial crash. And they're just not here at the moment because of travel restrictions. They're not able to access the market. We have had, I'm sure every agent in London has had situations where people have bought sight unseen, but predominantly people, you know, that's the minority rather than the majority of cases on the whole. Most people want to physically be here. It's a sort of a tangible thing, the property. And so they're delaying their acquisitions, they're delaying their moves, they're delaying their purchases. So London is sort of flat, really. Hasn't dropped. I mean, I think some indices are saying there's a sort of either a flat market with a sort of a plus 0.2 price growth, or a reduction of sort of, you know, up to sort of 2 or 3%. It just depends which indices you're looking at. Essentially, it's flat. And what's causing that, in my opinion, is this very peculiar nature of central London where people just don't need to sell. You know, they hold a property here as one of a portfolio of probably a number of property assets they hold, possibly in London or certainly in the UK, certainly across the globe. It's not the only place they own. It's not the only place they live. And if the market's not great, then they just hold it. They just live in it, let their kids live in it, rent it out, whatever they do with it. The very last thing they do is think prices have softened, so I'll sell it for a soft price. That's just never enters their head. That doesn't happen. So what you get with prime central London is you get this extraordinary drop in volume. So what we've seen is that volumes in prime central London are over 2020 were sub 3,000 transactions for the whole year. Now that is about 70% down from the peak of 12 to 13,000 back in sort of the mid 1990s, whenever it was. So that is a really clear indication that, you know, that's the flavour of the London market.
And so of course,
the question.
Yeah, no, very much so. And of course, now when we're seeing that volumes are up over 100% year on year, it's because the transaction volumes in 2020, especially this time last year, were so incredibly low, as you've just pointed out. So it's not normal, as you said right at the very beginning. And I've got a lot of follow-up questions to this. Obviously, when you've got pent-up demand, you need that supply side to be feeding into that. And we did see an increase in supply, and I know speaking with agents, they were saying that they've not seen this sort of volume since 2006 was one of the Foxton's agents actually said to me. So what do you think was fueling this supply then? As you said, not a lot of your clients are not necessarily selling, but what were causing other people to sell into this demand?
Well, I think a lot of it's the pandemic. I think a lot of it is it's caused people to really reflect on how they work, where they work, how they live and work, essentially. It's given people the freedom to really reevaluate everything. And in some cases, it sort of forced people to you know, live differently. So I think that's essentially, I think, what it is it's just this release of pent-up demand where people couldn't move, and suddenly finding that they don't have to live, you know, within a short commute from the centre of London or the centre of whatever city it is they commute into. And they're thinking, actually, we could have a really different sort of life, and we might have to commute in once or twice or not at all. And it suddenly opens up really opens up the door to totally rethink where you live. And I think that's a lot of what it is. I think the other thing that I think sort of people have forgotten a little bit about now, because the pandemic sort of wiped so many other things off the headlines. Mm-hmm. Brexit, in my mind, Brexit was a huge cause for people to sit on the fence and do nothing. They were worried. They weren't clear. They didn't know if it was going to happen or not. And they didn't know if it did happen, what the implication was for them personally or for the economy. So I think it's not just the pandemic. I think it goes back a few years, really, that there's this sort of real, you know, the the sort of release of all of that sort of demand, really.
Yeah, and there's one thing that a market likes least, and that is uncertainty, isn't it? And it doesn't matter if it's up or if it's down. What they don't like is uncertainty. And that was what Brexit and the referendum and all of that seemed to give us, was that level of uncertainty. Is that what you're finding with your clients as well?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's always the case. I mean, if you go way back pre-Brexit and everything, whenever you have a period of uncertainty, whether it's running up to a general election or running up to whether interest rates are going to go up or down, it's any level of uncertainty, you get a pause in volumes. You get people who are engaging with you, but they don't really commit. And then once everyone knows the decision, even if you don't like Brexit, if you don't like the idea of it, when you see that Boris has got a bigger majority than I think most people thought he was going to get in December 2019, suddenly the direction of travel becomes very clear. It's brought into stark relief what is going to happen. Everyone knew then that he was going to take us out come what may. And so everyone then feels comfortable, even if they don't like it. They think, well, I know what environment I'm trading in now, so I can assess my risk, or I can see the opportunity clearly, whichever way around they're thinking, and they take action. And that's always the case. So it does, from an agency perspective, it's always a bit frustrating because you think the opportunities sometimes lie. You know, the opportunities are best really when other people are holding off. But of course, most people don't. You know, they wait for others, they wait for the headlines, and then they pile in. Which means they have probably and have not such a good choice, but there we go. That's human nature.
It is, isn't it? And it's also the psychology of a market, is that we are trend driven, and that's why there's this whole rise in algorithm trading and etc. So, with London Central Portfolio, one of the great things and one of the reasons that you came onto my radar was the economic, I guess, or the market update emails that you send out regularly. And one of those is on, or one of the indicators that you look at is rental demand. And rents have dropped quite a lot. And I think it's important to address that, especially recent research came out that showed that it's now cheaper to rent a property than to have a mortgage. How is this also impacting on property prices, especially if people are investing their money for a long term as landlords rather than as owner occupiers?
Well, I think in the geographic that I'm most commonly dealing with, prime central London, the yield here has never been great anyway. And I think anyone who bought here for the yield was probably slightly misguided. It's very easy to rent here. You get a very good sort of occupancy level, but the yield has never been that attractive compared to cities beyond, where the values are lower and as a result the yields are higher. Prime central London has always been about capital appreciation, and people have bought here and held. And most of our clients at Prime, at LCP, they very, very rarely sell. We have clients here that have owned their properties for literally decades, and you know they showing no signs of wanting to sell anytime soon, and they just hold it for capital appreciation. Yields, have obviously come under strain in the last 12 months with the pandemic. I think to offer some reassurance on that, where we were in the very early days of sort of lockdown one pandemic hitting, we were just to get things rented because we didn't really know what to expect or how long it was going to last. You know, we were all, you know, living day by day. Yeah. We were offering discounts of sort of 15-20% to people just to get things let because we didn't know how long it was going to go on for. Now we're still at a discount, but it's 5%, not the 15 or so percent we were getting a year ago. Rents have firmed up a little. And what we've seen personally in our own portfolio, the properties we manage, we've seen that the really young people have really stepped in to fill the void that existed. And I think a lot of them have from speaking to them, I think they've sort of taken advantage of the softer rents. You know, they're quite savvy. Mm-hmm. And they thought, actually, let's live much more centrally than we definitely could have afforded before. And so they're sort of quite happy to move in very centrally, get a flat that, you know, is probably better than they would have imagined they could have got, and it's certainly a much nicer area than they would have imagined they could live in. And so sort of things have firmed up a little. But prices are still a little softer, and I think that this sort of August, September will be quite telling, because obviously for prime central London, we have a big high net worth overseas student market, and it's going to be really interesting to see how many of them arrive. Certainly from the phone calls and emails we're getting, there are going to be a lot of them, because a lot of them have got in touch with us and they're trying to book things ahead of schedule. So I think we're going to be very busy again come August, September. I think a lot of people are going to work on the basis that they can operate back at university in the normal ways this new academic year. So I think that the rents, I don't know if they'll recover exactly to where they were a year ago, but I think the discounts are not so easily come by now in the rental market.
Which is reassuring. And you mentioned that the younger people are stepping in to fill that void. What void is, whom has created that void? Which group? Is it young professionals or maybe families perhaps?
I think it's probably, it's across every sort of sector of society really. I think the one thing, that the one sort of trend, if you like, that we've really seen is the older people have left more than younger people. Last year, 2020, 90% of every new tenancy that we put in place, 90% of those people were under the age of 40. Whereas in the previous year, 2019, it was 80% of all our new tenancies, people were under the age of 40. And in Q3 last year versus Q3 of the previous year, 80% of all our new tenancies were actually under the age of 30. Whereas in the previous year, it was 60% of new tenancies. So it's a really big change of a really big move of younger people moving here, which you can imagine is for all sorts of reasons. But we're seeing that as a real vote of sort of medium to long-term vote of confidence in London as a centre, a destination of choice for employment and education, which I think is really encouraging. And I think it's probably potentially very important for London. I think London had got to a bit of an inflection point pre-pandemic, you know, in those sort of Brexit years. It was getting very expensive. It was becoming a bit unaffordable. I think it had, given the Brexit vote, it was potentially a little bit directionless. It wasn't quite sure, you know, who it was and where it was going. And I think that the silver lining in the pandemic, if you can put it that way, might be that London is forced to reinvent itself. And that big influx of the younger generation into town could be a really positive thing, because that's obviously what any city needs, is that sort of constant sense of reinvention and reinvigoration. So we're really positive. I'm personally very positive about London in the coming years because of what I'm seeing down here on the ground.
Yeah, and with this change over, we read a lot, especially this time last year, about people escaping to rural areas or seaside areas, and so that it seems that void now is being filled with young people. What about foreign buyers? What are you finding their responses like from a buying perspective now, given that there's also the increase in tax on foreign buyers? There's the Brexit, although some of the uncertainty has been taken out of that. What is your experience with foreign buyers now?
It's essentially that they're waiting in the wings and they're keen to get back here. I had a meeting a few days ago with someone who acts for a group of Middle Eastern banks, and he said all of his clients are stuck in the Gulf, in the Middle East, in the searing heat at this time of the year. And wishing they were here, wishing they were in London. Most of them would normally be here at this time of the year, spending the summer here. And one of the things they traditionally do is they buy a lot of real estate. They do love London real estate. It's an asset they're comfortable with and they're very confident in. And they're just really keen to get back here. We've seen a similar trend with all, a lot of our clients are overseas. It's one of the reasons they use us is they're not physically here all the time. So Far East and Middle East, Hong Kong, Singapore are biggest geographical areas that our clients come from. They're staying in touch, they're interested, and they're keen for all the reasons they've always been keen. They see London as a safe haven. They like it, you know, personally, they culturally, they like it, and they feel comfortable here with the rule of law. They mm-hmm. like running their businesses here. They've got the benefit of GMT time zone, so they can trade with Asia in the morning and the Americas in the afternoon. That's pretty important for a lot of them. They like getting their children educated here. Schools and universities here, they're very keen on. They want their children to speak English. I think English is still considered just as the global business language. So they're very keen on that. And they want their children to get their sort of first job here. And I think it's just got a lot of attractions. It's very, a lot of overseas people see London and the UK specifically as being European, but very unique within it being European. It's not like being on the continent. It's got its very own distinctive taste, flavors and smells. And they're historically, they've got a lot of links here. A lot of them have family here, have worked here and been educated here themselves. You know, most of them have got a better English education than I have. And most of them speak better English than I do. You know, they're keen to get back, but they're kind of forced to be on the sort of pause button temporarily.
It's a city that they feel very comfortable and I guess safe in, especially with our legal system, as you mentioned before, having that certainty. And apart from around Brexit, we also had quite a stable currency, I guess, and that's that whole foreign exchange side of things, and that can't be discounted either.
Yeah, a lot of them have very, I mean, two of the attractions here are political and currency stability, and it's exactly what they don't always benefit from in their own mm-hmm. territory, is political and currency stability. It's one of the things they're trying to get away from, and one of the reasons why they want to be here. So I think all of that is still in play for them. So I don't see, I don't think anything's changed particularly. And I think that if there's a, you know, a sort of a, London's been forced to press a bit of a reset button, and it is as a result a bit more affordable, then I think that's just going to make it even more attractive.
Yeah, it's an opportunity. And just one last question on the markets before we turn more to London Central Portfolio. With the prime London market, which you've worked in for three decades, it's all such growth, and I witnessed it firsthand as an owner of some prime real estate in Kensington, South Kensington, from 2015. I rode the wave up 2017 and then watched it collapse, and unfortunately made a loss on a property, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
Now, there was this perfect storm that created this this implosion of property prices in this prime market. Do you see that prices will recover? And if you do, within this subsector, what sort of time frame do you think? Because we still haven't reached the 2016 prices, and we're some properties are some 30% or so off those highs. So what's your outlook for that sector?
I think it will recover. I'm really confident of that. And I think that all of the big research houses are predicting by sort of 2024 that you'll see about a 25% growth by that period, during that period. So I don't think there's any, you know, there are, the general consensus is that will happen. And I think that if you cast your mind back to the period of 2009 through to 2012, we saw a very similar price growth in that very sort of condensed period of time. Mm-hmm. London has this habit. I described the EU referendum in June 2016, was it June 2016? It was like the London market being given a slow puncture, and the sort of the air was just sort of coming out. You know, it was just getting softer and softer for that whole period, all the way through to the election of December 2019, and you know, prices just gently softening off across that whole period. The recovery, generally speaking, in London is much, much, much quicker, and you have to be careful because it can sort of smack you in the face. It can happen so quickly. You can miss it. It happens so quickly, and you only have to look at what happened post credit crunch for evidence, or sort of recent. It's not that long ago. Evidence of how very quickly it can recover. So everybody I talk to, clients, other professionals within the industry, everybody is predicting that it will recover quickly, relatively quickly. I think it's all, for Central London, it's all locked up in travel restrictions. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that, funnily enough, London has become relatively affordable now compared to other parts of the UK. Other parts of the UK, certain areas haven't really seen proper price growth for over a decade, 10, 15 years. That some places, certain parts of the northeast of England, the prices are even, you know, lower even now than they were sort of 10, 15 years ago. So there's been a real sort of balancing off effect from June 16 onwards. So I think, relatively speaking, London is, I know it's a very, very expensive city still, but it is more affordable. And I can remember in the early 1990s, suddenly London, relative to the rest of the UK, really looked pretty affordable. And I think we're sort of in that environment now, where there are occasions where it's, you know, you can buy things at a pretty good discount to where they were, you know, not that long ago. Those things aren't easy to find, but they do exist. So I think, you know, I think for those reasons, I think it will, there's going to be I'm hesitant to say it's going to be a boom and that it's going to happen really quickly or anything, because I don't sort of want to predict, you know, that. But I think it will be a strong, stable, you know, recovery, you know, a really good recovery over the next few years.
Are your foreign buyers and local buyers as well, are they interested in cities other than London?
Depends who you're talking to. Some are, and I think that we've seen this with some Hong Kong buyers. There's a new wave of Hong Kong buyers, as well documented in the press, new wave of Hong Kong buyers accessing the UK market. Most of those new buyers are heading to cities further north, Liverpool, Birmingham, Manchester. A lot of them have got, or even Glasgow, a lot of them have got family up there and relatives up there. And they're comfortable up there. It's more moderately priced, and it's more affordable for that new generation of buyer. The ones that are sticking to London are the people that are sort of already here, really. They've already got connections in London. They've got businesses here. They own property here already, and they're very familiar with London. They're not new to London. So some do like cities outside London, but I would say the Middle Eastern buyer, there's an awful lot of overseas buyers. They don't really see the UK. They just see London, and they're blind to everything beyond it. They don't want to be in Cotswolds or, you know, in Liverpool or something. They don't understand it. They don't get it. They've really got little or no interest. Everything they want is connected from a business perspective, is connected to all the ancillary industries that have grown up over the last two or three decades around the financial city of London. Everything they want is here. And they're, as we said, number of occasions, that they're comfortable here. They're at home here. Mm-hmm. They know their way around. And they've got family and business here, and the rest of the UK is unknown to most of them, I would say.
Yeah, it very much supports the long-term growth, I guess, the interest in London. And it's interesting that the newer buyers from Hong Kong, as we're seeing this unrest in Hong Kong, Hong Kong's long had an association with the UK, so that it's only natural that the UK becomes a safe haven for people looking to protect their assets longer term. Turning to London Central Portfolio, the company's been running since 1989, which is quite admirable, isn't it, for a company of that type. I think it's as I said to you when we had our first call, when I first came across LCP, if you don't mind me calling it that, it was a company that I thought, wow, this is the goal. This is what I want to build and develop out. And it didn't work like that. But it has a very long history and a very solid history. Can you talk to us about the how it started and how it has grown over the last couple of decades?
Yeah, so it's grown essentially from trying to address the market of expats who want, for whatever reason, want London property, but aren't necessarily physically here to manage the process. And I suppose our typical stereotypical client is high net worth. We call them high net worth delegators. And the reason for that is that they're very successful in their own industry, their own field of expertise. But when it comes to residential property in London, either because they're too busy, is very often the case, they're not necessarily always physically here, or they don't consider themselves to have the relevant expertise. And they value expertise. They're experts in their own field, and they are happy to pay, and they seek expertise in whatever it is they do in their life, and they want someone to give them advice on where, when, and how when it comes to London residential property. And we address that market. They don't have to be overseas, and we have lots of UK-based clients as well, obviously, but it is somebody that in whatever walk of life, they appreciate and value expertise. They're not vain enough to think that they're an expert when it comes to residential property, and they want someone to act on their behalf and give them guidance within the sector. So we address the topic holistically. So we're not purely transactional. We don't just sell them a property and then say goodbye. We put enormous effort into that element of our service. Search and acquisition is obviously a key element of what we deliver and what we offer, but it goes way beyond that. Our clients stick with us for generations. We're a boutique-sized business. We're a small boutique-sized business, and we have the outlook, the philosophy of a family office. So we have clients, we act for their whole family over generations, and we address from search and acquisition through to then refurbishment. A lot of the properties we buy need refurbishing. Those are the types of properties that we steer people towards. We have less competition on the way in, and we can add value pretty much immediately by refurbishing it. And so we do the design and build, and then we let and manage. A lot of them want to rent their property out for permanently or just some of the time. So we do all of that in-house as well. And some of them use us just for vacant management. They're here for 3 months of the year, and we conduct vacant management for the time when they're not here. So that's sort of what we do in a nutshell. I think best way of
Yeah, no, indeed. And it's, how many properties do you currently manage on behalf of clients?
Well, there's about 500 units in the portfolio that we rent on a day-to-day basis. I think assets under management is just over about £1 billion, all in prime central London.
Wow, so that's a huge amount of administration, and you must have quite a big team managing that on behalf of the client. So I'm assuming that it's short lets as well as the normal AST?
We can do short lets, but we don't. It's very much the rarity. We tend to do ASTs. We tend to do long-term tenancies, which is what our clients prefer. Yeah, we've got quite a big team. I say a big team. It's we're relatively small. There's 20 of us, and we all fit in this building. The key thing is we don't outsource anything at all. So we have experts in their fields in all the different departments. And the reason our clients like that is that they effectively have one person for everything. They don't need to contact someone else. It's they've got one point of contact, which are the type of client we have. It's very important for them that everything's under one roof and they can get easy access to anything they need from us.
And what's the average property that you manage on behalf of clients or purchase on behalf of your clients?
I don't think that, I mean, the silly answer, but there sort of isn't really an average. I suppose last year we bought everything from small one-bedroom units at £600,000 or £700,000 that needed totally renovating to a couple of hotels for nearly £100 million. And sort of everything in between. I suppose our the majority of things fall into two categories. It's either homes that people live in, so it's 4, 5, 6 million pound properties that people live in, or it's investment properties. And when people come to us and they say we want to invest, they usually come here with a number of millions of pounds, you know, 2 or 3 million pounds, and they think that they should buy a house. And obviously the first thing we say is, well, we don't think you should do that. We think you should buy multiple units, smaller units as you can find. If you're going to rent them out, you don't get a better yield for the extra large flat, for the extra square footage. So you're better off buying a smaller unit. The yields are better. And the demand from a rental perspective is stronger. They're easier to rent. They have lower void periods. So those are the two, I suppose, if the majority of our property falls into one or two of those categories.
Yeah. Now, let's just turn more now towards you and your career. And as I said in the introduction, you've had over 30 years at Foxtons, ending up as the managing director there as well. So that must have been a really interesting phase to work with Foxtons over all of that growth. Yeah, exactly. Because Foxtons were incredibly, they revolutionized, I would say, the whole real estate agency market in the UK. And so how did you come to work with them? And just talk to me about your experience working with them over the decades.
It's a long story.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. We have time, Andrew.
It's a colourful and interesting story because it was a colourful and interesting company. I mean, it was an amazing company to be part of for a chunk of time. I came to it, if I'm really honest, totally by chance. I moved to London as a 20-year-old. I wanted to be an estate agent. I thought it was – I'm from the north of England. I'm from Cheshire. And for me, as a 20-year-old, there was only one place in the UK, in the world, that I wanted to be. That was London. For me, it was the most colourful place. It was literally like moving from, I always describe it, it was like having, you know, living with a black and white TV and suddenly living with a colour TV. For those of your audience who can remember that there used to be such a thing, London was just off the scale, dynamic. Yeah. It was a real place of opportunity, is a real place of opportunity for a young person in your 20s. You know, you just feel like you can sort of do anything, be anything. And there were sort of no limits. And I thought property at the time, the market was really busy. And I thought that would be really exciting. It would be fun. And it was. And I applied to lots of different estate agents. I literally got a Foxtons magazine through the door, which was advertising for a position. I answered it, had two interviews and got a job as a sort of a trainee negotiator, and didn't look back. It was an extraordinary company to work for. It was a very small company when I started. It was three offices and about 30 people, and from memory, about 30, 35 people. We were tiny. But it felt like a much bigger company because we were doing something unique. John Hunt, who obviously was the founder, very well known as the was the visionary behind the business, and he was an extraordinary leader and a great visionary. And he just had a very different way of doing things, which it's difficult. You can't really look back. It's difficult to look back now. But he changed the way the industry operates. Yeah. And it was London was a very different city then, and the estate agency industry was unrecognizable compared to what it is today. And he played no small part in those changes, really. So as a young person, it was a really exciting place to work. I was surrounded by like-minded people, all worked. I mean, we would work easily 6 days a week, sometimes seven. 12-hour days were nothing. We were open from 8 in the morning till 9 in the evening. We were open all day Saturday, all day Sunday. I mean, it was a very busy time. And it was a great place, you know, and I learned a huge amount. It was the learning curve was steep and really interesting. So I was very fortunate.
Yeah, I like how you described coming to London as switching from black and white to colour, and that's exactly my experience as well. And I didn't know you had a northern accent until you said one. And then I could just get that tweak of a northern accent that's still there. Yeah, I thought that Foxton's really did revolutionise it. And if you go outside of London, I'm not sure if you've had many dealings outside of London, particularly to more provincial style estate agencies, and you'll see what London used to be like pre-Foxton's. And one of the great things that you brought in as well is the open home on Sunday, because of course there are Sunday trading laws, which means you can't technically sell houses on a Sunday, but you could have open homes. So how did they go for Foxton's, and did you enjoy those?
Well, it's one of these things you sort of forget what London used to be like. London was closed for business on a Sunday. I mean, it was literally closed. And speaking as someone that used to work on Saturdays, I can remember it was quite a struggle to find somewhere to buy food on a Sunday. Everything was closed. So the idea of the we called it Sunday market or open house, and the idea was just to be honest with you, was sort of driven by the need for efficiency in a very busy market. Estate agency was quite inefficient because you've got one person taking another person to a house. It's very sort of manual labor, if you like. It's inefficient. So the concept was to try and have periods of, you know, a couple of hours where our properties were open by appointment, by, you know, previous appointment, and you could book a slot and you could show maybe 10 or a dozen people around the property in that time. One person could conduct, you know, a dozen viewings in the time that it would, you know, it was a great efficiency driver. And that was the reason that we did it. That was the sort of the driver behind it. And then obviously it caught on. But it is something I know places around, I think there are other places around the world, I think in the States and Australia and New Zealand, open house is something that people are very familiar with. But it was totally alien here. It was not, London didn't. It was always, you would always show a single person would conduct a single viewing. So it was very slow. And when the market was busy, we just sort of needed to try and improve efficiency. So that's where the concept originated from.
And it had the other benefit of when the market was booming, of having multiple people looking around a property at the same time and realizing that they were going to have to put in a pretty decent offer if they were going to win the price war.
Yeah, it took quite a bit. It needed to be carefully managed because not everybody liked that. They didn't, they didn't really like being sort of, herded into a property and herded back out again. So it needed to be managed very carefully. But it did inevitably, you would always cross on the doorway with another buyer. And so it really did encourage people, or it sort of showed them the reality of how many other people they were out there competing with. So it did achieve a great result for the seller. You know, Foxton's, if nothing else, always had a very clear understanding of who it was acting for, and that was most definitely the seller. That's what we were known for. And it was very clearly skewed in favour of the seller. I mean, having said that, some buyers liked it for the same reason, because it meant they could access properties at a time that was convenient for them. One of the things Foxton's did was introduced the sort of the concept of being user-friendly and not closing at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening and staying open later and being around at the weekends. So it was, it all sort of fitted into that sort of thought process and philosophy, really.
Yeah, it's simple now when we think about it. Just be around when your client or your those looking to consume are most available, and that is evenings and weekends. And in Australia, it is very common to have the open house. And I remember being pulled through houses on a Sunday with me and my three brothers being bribed, threatened to behave ourselves as we peeked around people's homes. So it was quite revolutionary for me, again, to use that word, to see it here in London. So as your time then grew at Foxton's and Foxton's changed, and I should say that I personally have always enjoyed working with Foxton's, and I know that some people don't view their experience with Foxton's so favourably, but I definitely do. And I have bought and sold, I would say, over a dozen properties with Foxton's over the last 10, 12 years. And even now, I've got four properties on the market with Foxton's, and you've just sold another four for me. So I've got a very good experience. And I find that while they are very unapologetic that their client is the seller, they always looked after me as a buyer as well. And especially James Davidson, a shout out to him. He was excellent in the Hackney office. And unfortunately, he's not there anymore, but he was very, very good.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed working with him. But this is something that people don't realize, is that the agent works not for you, but for the seller. That is their client. So they're always looking for the best outcome for their seller. And this is where, to give you a plug, a buying agent like yourselves at London Central Portfolio really comes to the fore.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, agencies like Foxton's do a great job, you know, and they're one of the strongest agents in London for a reason, is because they do work very hard, and they have a very clear internal culture and understanding of what their purpose is, and they do that very well still. I suppose the challenge for buyers is, as you've said, is that they get lulled into a false sense of security by very charming people like Jim Davidson, who you work with, for your evidence of the fact that he was very good at charming you into that sort of feeling almost that he was acting for you. Well, you know, I mean, he wasn't, but you know, you felt that he was, and that's the challenge for buyers, and that really is where people like me at LCP and buying agents really, that's really our greatest sort of function, really, is ensuring that the buyer's interests are carefully considered and protected. And there are some real practical considerations as well. Perhaps you made it your living to spend, you know, you made it your job, your day job, to be out looking at properties. Most other people are very, very busy keeping down a day job, looking after their children, picking them up, dropping them off, at the same time as trying to manage relationships with maybe a dozen agents in an area that they focus on and want to move to. So buying agents, what if nothing else, they do a great service of funneling all of that and ensuring that everything that comes on the market is put under your nose at an appropriate moment. The filtration process is very important. You don't have your time wasted, because they filter out the things that you don't want to see, that agents will drag around. And they ensure that something that's really good and is sort of potentially perfect for you, that it's put squarely under your nose and you're got in there quickly. So it's a great efficiency having a buying agent. And then when it comes to things like, sometimes we have to advise people not to buy something. You know, they like it, but we have concerns about it for various reasons. You know, not every house on a good street is a great house. You know, you can be at the wrong end of the street, the wrong side of the street. There's all sorts of things that you have to be really sort of mindful of. And then obviously the big question is price. You know, again, if nothing else, we can report very, you know, in great detail what that property is worth on paper versus every other house that's sold that's similar within the required time period. So we can give people comfort that they're not overpaying, or frankly, even being very commercial about it. that if they are overpaying, they know by how much they're overpaying. Mm. So they know what they're getting into, which is a slightly strange thing to say. But one of the things you have to be aware of in the geographic that we tend to deal with is people are reluctant to part company with a AAA grade quality asset, which in a good year can go up, can appreciate by, you know, double digit growth. You know, there aren't a huge amount of investments around the world that can deliver that and be capable of you living in it at the same time or renting it out. So, you know, not everybody wants to sell these assets. So if you find one you want, sometimes it's more about, it's not just about what it's worth. Sometimes it's about what do I need to pay to get the seller to part company with it. And, you know, that is the conversation we have to have with clients sometimes. It's like, well, it's not cheap, but it is an amazing house. And you might have to pay a bit over the top. But clearly, when you come to sell, you will probably sell it for a bit over the top for the very same reasons you're, you know. So it's having your eyes wide open, and it's having full, you know, detailed, experienced knowledge, so that you're acquiring, you know, really with confidence. So I suppose that's often something that buying agents do, which is not always fully appreciated, in my opinion.
Yeah, and when you're, as you said right in the very beginning of this discussion, that a lot of your clients are buying for a very long time, almost intergenerational purchases. So for them, paying extra 5% over the top of value is not important, as long as they're aware of that, because they're holding for so long, decades.
And it's a conversation I've had countless times of late, because some of our buyers are like, well, look, Andrew, I've read the newspapers, I know the travel restrictions, why is my discount not bigger? if buying cheaply is your primary objective, you will probably end up buying something that is not of the, you know, in my opinion, is not of a great standard, a great quality. I personally rather pay the going rate, or even a little bit over the going rate, but be really confident that I bought a fabulous property that's going to appreciate in the good times, will really appreciate above the market. So these are sort of conversations I've had a lot recently, and it's like, well, look, I know you'll probably feel like you are going, we are asking, that the seller is asking you to overpay a little bit more than you're comfortable with. But actually, if you wait for travel restrictions to lift fully, you'll probably, well, you'll certainly have more competition, obviously, because everyone will be piling in through Heathrow. But the sellers will just be demanding more as well for the same reason. And you'll probably end up paying even more than you're being asked to pay now. So I think you have to look, you have to look sideways sometimes and not get too hung up on the what's immediately at the end of your nose. And sometimes you have to look a little bit beyond, am I paying exactly the right price? Am I getting a discount? Because clearly those are very important things, and we try and achieve the right price for the seller. We clearly don't want someone to be overpaying where they don't have to. But there is more. We try and take a slightly longer term view, on the basis that our clients are in it for the long term, and they appreciate residential property in London is a long term play. So we have to remind them of that sometimes.
And especially the type of homes and houses that they are buying. These are not your new build off plan that you can expect a discount for. This is prime central London, and they're one of a kind. They're not homogenous, I guess is the term.
Yeah, well, that's another interesting topic, because obviously a lot of our clients say, should I buy new build or should I buy period heritage? Difficult question to answer, because both is good. I suppose typically we steer them towards heritage, we steer them towards period. Mm. Partly that's a geographical thing, because of where we tend to buy. Well over half the property in prime central London is sort of 150 odd years plus old. It is that type of property. But also we like the fact that it's a constrained resource. You can't build more of it. New build is great, and it performs its function very successfully. you do tend to have to pay a premium. There's no question about that, because the developer is able to achieve that premium because it's all brand new and it is, you know, fresh out of the box. It's, you know, it's quite convenient for a certain type of buyer. But you do have to wait at least one cycle before you're really seeing any capital appreciation. And the fear for me is that hundreds of them come available at any one time. Hundreds of them become available to rent at any one time. So you've got always got a lot of competition. Period heritage property in the very prime areas, it's the reverse of that. So it's a bit like buying a BMW or a Ferrari. I always do that comparison. It's like BMWs are great, but there's an awful lot of them around. The right Ferrari will appreciate considerably because it is a constrained resource. It's a collector's item and it will probably go up in price. The BMW probably won't. So it's horses for courses. There's nothing wrong with new build, but as a house, we tend to acquire period, characterful, you know, heritage property. We as I say, we like the nature of it being a constrained resource.
Yeah. And as one Foxton agent said to me when I first started my property search in London, having just been fresh off the boat from Australia, he said to me, buying property in London is always a compromise. So I guess what you're saying is that you don't mind so much if your clients are compromising on price, as long as they're not compromising on location and quality.
Exactly. And it's a good bit of advice whoever gave you that. Maybe, you know, it's a real Foxtonism. it's very true. And I see it time and time again. It doesn't matter whether you're buying a property at, you know, half a million or at 10 million. You would be amazed, buyers at multiples of millions. You know, people are buying at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 million. Believe it or not, they compromise, because obviously the bigger your budget, the more you have on your wish list. And so inevitably they end up compromising. It's very rare that even at 10 million quid, somebody walks away with everything on their wish list ticked. It just doesn't really happen. It's one of the most important things for a buyer to appreciate, because otherwise it can just be very frustrating because you're looking for perfection. And of course, perfection, as we all know, doesn't exist. You do need to make
exactly. Exactly. Well, Andrew, we've run out of time. I think we could sit and chat for another hour at least, and I'd love to have you back on maybe later in the year or in the new year and talk about how Prime Central London is faring. So, Andrew, thank you so much for your time. It's been very insightful.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on. It's been lovely to chat, and look forward to speaking again as the market develops in the coming months.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.